This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 222, was recorded on June 4th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is dedicated to healthcare workers all over the world, the true heroes of the COVID-19 pandemic crisis, and is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Vikram Mancharamani joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss how supply chains are restructuring around the globe in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, the coming secular shift from deflation to inflation, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment, where we'll discuss the sudden increase in civil unrest in the United States, what it means, where it's headed, and what signs investors should watch for in the markets and in the news flow.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's dive into the S&P 500, which a little bit of a pause today at 3,100, but it's been pretty much a steady climb higher, just crawling. It's not even huge momentum on the upside, but it's just every day seems to make a little bit of progress. Where's this all going?
Well, you know, Patrick, the old adage is the time to buy stocks is when they're really low, when there's blood in the streets. Well, unfortunately, we've got blood in the streets in the most literal sense. Yet we're basically, and it looks to me like we're in a rally which is headed toward all-time highs. On a Fibonacci basis, we're well past the 61.8% retracement. Looks to me like we're headed to all-time highs. So how is that possible when you've literally got a global pandemic and riots breaking out across the United States? How could it possibly be? We'll go into more detail on the civil unrest aspects of this in the post-game segment, but I think the only real explanation here is it's the expectation that investors have that the Fed is going to continue to accommodate. And BMO this week put out a poll of their clients asking them, what's driving this rally? 76% said it's the Fed. So I think that's the pretty clear explanation of what's going on. Now, Patrick, as I think about the big picture and where we're all headed, a lot of people, myself included, have been holding on to this view for the last 10 years that, hey, this rally has been artificial. It's been created by central bank largesse, not by real economic fundamentals. Therefore, it's all going to end badly someday. Well, I still think it's going to end badly, but I'm not sure that it's ever going to result in any kind of major stock market crash. I think we could be headed into an environment where we're both anticipating more accommodation from the Fed. That's helping the rally. But part of it, too, is I think we are headed toward that secular shift from deflation to inflation. Now, remember, as much as inflation eventually can have a debilitating effect on the stock market, as happened in the 1970s, generally speaking, the beginning of an inflation event is almost always good for the stock market. So there's plenty of room to expect a shift to inflation to take the market considerably higher from here. So, you know, maybe we never see that big downside event that so many of us thought was inevitable. I'm really starting to open my mind to that view. I probably am long overdue in taking the step. You know, I really don't believe in the fundamentals, the old school fundamentals behind this market. But I ought to be participating in the upside with a strategy to say roll 40 delta calls or do something similar that allows me to at least participate in the trend upside while protecting myself if there is a crash at some point, as I've long predicted that there might be.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar because, I have to be the first to admit that I was anticipating it to resolve itself to the upside, but clearly this breakdown driven by a very decisive breakout in the euro has really taken hold here. What's your take on this whole dollar?
Well, I mean, it kind of makes sense. We literally have blood in the streets, and the government's ability to maintain order in the United States is in question. And this is all happening in an election season. So the idea that the U.S. dollar has kind of taken a beating here really shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody. On the other hand, I suppose, you know, if this all got under control, I wouldn't be surprised to see us, you know, jerk back to the upside. The next big technical test, though, if we assume that the dollar is going to continue to move down from here, would be a daily close below 94.5.
Let's move on to crude oil, because crude, it's been doing the same characteristic as the stock market, really. It's been just crawling up a little bit every single day. We're around the 37 handle on the July contract here. What's your take on oil? Is there another correction coming at some point, or is this just going to hold up here?
Well, a lot of smart people have been saying that we're long overdue for a big correction, but it hasn't come yet. Why not? I think that a lot of what's fueled this rally all the way up to the 100-day moving average, and we're just a tiny bit below it right now. I've got the 100-day on the contract chart at 37.61. We're at 37.18 as we're recording on Thursday afternoon, so we're less than 50 cents below the 100-day, and we've tested it a couple of times in the last couple of days. What got us here? I think it was speculation about OPEC Plus extending production cuts. Now, I'm going to add a little bit of my own interpretation to events here. What I think has happened was the OPEC Plus meeting was supposed to be today, where it was expected that they would make that announcement. As they were coming into this meeting and they figured out that Iraq is really not complied with the agreement, it's kind of funny. They're talking about extending cuts because the period during which the cut was supposed to be effective is coming to an end, but Iraq hasn't really even begun to actually comply with the original agreement, never mind extending it. You know, you can't extend Iraq's participation in something that Iraq has failed to participate in at all so far. So that seems to be where the rub is, and rather than have the meeting and have to, you know, have the outcome of the meeting be no action, they decided instead to postpone the meeting. So the meeting of OPEC Plus that was supposed to be today is delayed, and nobody's sure exactly when it's rescheduled for. Meanwhile, the two technical committees, which are part of OPEC itself, that's the JMC and the JMMC technical committee meetings, have been pushed out to June 17th and 18th. So hopefully by June 18th, we should have some resolution to this. Meanwhile, crude oil inventory drawing down 2.1 million barrels. Now, that was after a build in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve of 4 million barrels. So if you net out the SPR build, it comes to an effective build of 1.9 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, though, still drawing down 1.7 million barrels. So you've got a build on U.S. crude oil inventories, but only a fairly small one. The thing is, it's the finished products where the really big builds happened. Gasoline building 2.8 million barrels. Now, that's a pretty darn big build right there on gasoline. 2.8 million barrels, but it's distillates. Holy cow, 9.9 million barrels. I don't know where they're all putting it. There's been rumors in the industry about they're running out of storage for distillates for weeks now, and they keep on building inventories, and I guess they somehow have not run out of storage for it. U.S. production down 200,000 barrels to 11.2 million barrels. And again, I think that number's lagging. I think the real decline in U.S. production is probably bigger than what's been reported. There's a lot of articles that have been circulating saying, okay, folks, the storage problem is anything but over. Sounds ominous. Okay, but you know, if you look at the time spreads on WTI crude oil, it's telling us that it really is over. Now, I can't believe it myself. How could we have gotten past this major demand destruction event? They're already starting to restart some of these wells as prices recover. Where are we going to put all this oil? Well, for some reason, at least what the time spreads are telling us is the market is not worried about running out of storage again. So the jury is out as to what happens from here. I think at this point, having rallied already this high, a major, as you know, Patrick, in technical analysis, gap fills seem to be just something that traders turn into a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's a gap on the chart. Everybody's convinced it has to be filled. Well, we've already rallied all the way up to almost 38 bucks here. It's only another $3 to get to 41, and it's just above 41 that would fill that big, wide, open gap from when everything really started to fall apart at the beginning of the coronavirus crisis. So I wouldn't be surprised if this rally continues up to just over 41 to close the gap, but at some point, it feels to me like we're way overdue already for some kind of significant correction. And I don't mean new lows or anything like that. Obviously, it's going to be next to impossible to go lower than minus $40 a barrel that we set back on the expiry of the May contract at the end of April. But, you know, I think a correction back down to 25 or so would be part of a healthy recovery rally. And we're overdue for that. So at some point, it's coming. But so far, no sign of it.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because like a ping pong, it seems to be bouncing between, you know, more or less, I'm rounding 1700 to 1750, but back and forth and doesn't seem to resolve on a breakout. Reminds me, the dollar was doing the same thing for a while, and then finally the dollar began, but gold's still pinned in here. Which way is the gold going to go here?
Well, I keep getting my hopes up for lower numbers because I'd love to see a deep technical correction so that we could buy more. I couldn't be more positive about the long-term fundamentals for gold, so I'd love to see lower numbers so that I can buy some more. I'm starting to feel a little more optimistic that that might happen, and the reason I say that is this week's version of the correction down to 1700 bucks. Kind of came without any good fundamental explanation. What are the reasons that you usually see weakness in gold? Well, good news in the world. When geopolitical tensions and so forth are de-escalating, then that sometimes causes gold to sell off. Well, we're not de-escalating. We've literally got riots in the streets across the United States, and we're in the middle of a global pandemic. Another reason for gold to sell off is a particularly strong U.S. dollar. Well, we got the opposite. We got a weak dollar. And of course, our friend Josh Crum, in an interview here on Macro Voices, explained the reasons why the price of crude oil can drag gold prices down with it when crude oil prices are crashing. Well, guess what? Crude oil is unexpectedly strong here. So none of the obvious suspects explain why the weakness, why we're testing 1700 again. This is probably partially hopeful thinking on my part, Patrick, but I really am starting to feel like maybe we're getting close to that downside breakdown, because I do think that we're overdue. We're holding on to 1700 sort of psychological round number support here. If that breaks, I think we could see a significant correction to the downside. Maybe that's just wishful thinking. We'll see.
Eric, let's touch on the 10-year treasury yields. Now, I want to elaborate more on it in the post game, but do you have, just during this initial market wrap, do you have any comments on what's going on?
Well, just that we are finally, after consolidating in a very, very narrow range, it looks like maybe it's starting to resolve to the upside. That's going to cause the momentum chasers and the trend followers and so forth potentially to start selling bonds here. Let's wait till the post-game segment when we can look at some charts and get into more detail.
This week's feature interview guest is Vikram Mancharamani. Why did we invite Vikram as a guest this week?
Well, Patrick, Vikram was actually referred to us by our good friend Grant Williams, who said, you got to interview this guy. And I have a lot of respect for Grant. I should say Grant, as he prefers to be pronounced. And I have to agree, Vikram has got a lot of excellent perspective on a number of macro topics, ranging from supply chains to inflation, deflation, and so forth. So I think you'll really enjoy this interview. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup-Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Vikram is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here on macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Vikram Mancharamani, Harvard University lecturer and author of, first, the book Boombustology, but Vikram also has a new book coming out next week called Think for Yourself. We'll find out a little bit more about that at the end of the interview. Vikram, I want to start with what's on everybody's mind. Okay, seems like at least for the first wave, the worst is behind us in this COVID-19 crisis. So what does the economic recovery look like? Is it V-shaped, U-shaped, L-shaped, W-shaped, some other symbol-shaped? What should we expect in terms of what happens next economically?
Well, it's a great question, Eric. And of course, the alphabet soup of describing economic activity today has become quite the rage. One letter that I've recently heard, which I think is quite fascinating, is a lowercase h, meaning that we went straight down, we're bouncing and sort of rolling over only to go back down and no apparent sign of return at that stage. You know, my sense is that we're probably more towards a W-type trajectory. And the rationale is as follows. We obviously had a big downdraft. And when I start talking to a bunch of people about the fact that the consumers are saving money, they haven't had a chance to spend money, and the support from the government, unemployment, more money in people's pockets without the expenditure rate that they used to have means that they've effectively been saving. And folks are really chomping at the bit to go out and do something. And so I think that there's some possibility of a bounce. However, I don't think it's a sustainable bounce. And the reason I don't think it's sustainable is if you just look at the unemployment numbers. If we look at the unemployment numbers, I think they're massively underestimating true unemployment right now, mainly through this PPP program. You know, we've basically used the PPP program to funnel unemployment insurance through firms. And therefore, the unemployment numbers through the Bureau of Labor Statistics would be higher, I think, if we hadn't done it in that way. Now, some portion of that perhaps might not ultimately lead to unemployment, but some portion of the PPP-funded employees will result in unemployment. So I think there's some upside pressure on unemployment. But that's the quick summary of my thinking.
Now, just this past weekend, we had a major increase in civil unrest all around the United States. Some people are saying, okay, that's because George Floyd was killed by a police officer. It's all a reaction to that event specifically. Other people are saying, oh, wait a minute, it's really more of pent-up anger and frustration over a lot of issues. Some people think it is the fact that people have been cooped up in this lockdown over the crisis that's led to all of this. How do you interpret the meaning of this increase in civil unrest? What is it telling us, and what signals should investors interpret from it?
Sure. So if you had asked me which of those I was thinking is perhaps the most prevalent cause, I would have said yes, meaning all of the above are probably true. Yes, there was a catalyst. Yes, people have felt cooped up. Yes, there's an overarching feeling, I believe, among the American population that the system is rigged, that it's not fair, and therefore we need to do something about that. There's, of course, very visible signs of systemic racism, which is unacceptable, and all of the above. I think the way to think this through as an investor or someone paying more attention to the economic and financial implications of the unrest is this is just another issue that I think will create downside pressure on economic activity. I think people are getting nervous. I think it will cause perhaps a secular wave of deurbanization. We've been so excited about living in urban areas. With that comes all sorts of interesting implications, whether it's, you know, this mixed-use housing, real estate implications, etc. urban living may seem less desirable for some period of time going forward, whether it's the density because of the public health concerns or now the urban unrest that's been striking in many cities. So I think that's one possible implication to think about. Another possible implication to think about is, you know, we're starting to see companies like Amazon as well as Target say, hey, we're not going to operate in certain jurisdictions while this unrest is rising. So that's also problematic. But ultimately, I think it also has an impact on possibly the election cycle. And I haven't thought through enough to be able to comment on where it goes, but I do think this is going to become a more and more prevalent issue on the minds of political candidates at all levels, local, state, and national. So I think there's some pretty big implications for the unrest. Ultimately, it may even be, to some extent, more than just a public safety and policing concern. I think it has the potential to snowball very dramatically into inequality of all sorts. And that, I think, could result in a greater pressure towards socialist-like policies. And what I mean by that is probably more redistribution tendencies on the part of government policies. So, you know, a lot there. I'm happy to dive deeper in any of those if you'd like. You know, that's my quick high-level thinking about it.
Let's start with the things that might change as a result of this pandemic crisis, the changes that have been forced that might become permanent. The one I've been thinking about quite a bit is, you know, people have been forced, companies have been forced to learn to deal with most workers working at home. And it's gone better than expected for a lot of them. Is this going to lead to a new trend where people just say, hey, wait a minute, this whole business of there having to be the overhead of an office and everybody works in an office and most people are not allowed to work at home needs to change? Or do we go back to the pre-crisis normal?
Yeah, Eric, I think it's a great question. I think absolutely we're going to see more people working remotely. We saw that with Facebook indicating that half. We've seen it with other companies saying that that's true. It's a greater form of efficiency. I think we will have some office space that companies will retain because having in-person gatherings and sort of the fortuitous interactions that come from social mingling will still be desirable. But you don't need it 5 days a week for 100% of your staff. And so I think office space probably does see a headwind against it for that reason. And I do think the technology's improved tremendously for virtual work and virtual collaboration and virtual communication. And folks are finding that, you know what? I don't really enjoy spending an hour getting into some mass transit system to get downtown into an urban setting to go to an office where I work for a while, and then I do the same thing in reverse. So I do think that's probably a more permanent pressure. And I say pressure because it's not binary, obviously. You know, some percentage will work from home, some percentage will work in the offices, and I think the percentage working from home is going to be rising, and that'll be more of a structural tailwind towards remote work. And that has implications for a lot of things, including, you know, education and how people educate and remote education and all of the above. So yeah, I do think that's right. That specific point. And if we play through that point, Eric, and think about some of the second order effects of more remote work, you might say, okay, well, what does that do for demand for transportation and mass transit in certain urban areas? Well, probably less demand on the margin. Add on top of that the density of mass transit. And you say, okay, well, does that mean there's more demand for vehicles if people drive? Well, on the margin, yes, more demand for vehicles because people would prefer a vehicle over mass transit. But also on the margin, less demand for vehicles because fewer people are going to be driving into urban areas. So, you know, maybe vehicles are a push, but probably also less corporate gatherings, less flying around the country to get together for a 3 or 4 hour meeting. And that means there's probably downside pressure on hotels, probably downside pressure on airlines, probably downside pressure on transportation, probably downside pressure on rental cars, et cetera, and the whole ecosystem that supports this movement of, you know, business people around the country.
Vikram, I know you're good at thinking out of the box, so I want to take this just a little farther. We've talked about work at home and the first and second order implications of that. What if we go much broader to just what else could change? What are the, let's say, what are the least obvious implications of this crisis? What are we going to look back on 5 years from now and say, nobody saw this change coming?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question, Eric. I mean, one area I've been spending a lot of time thinking about, mainly because of my role as a faculty member at Harvard, is the future of education and thinking about in-person education versus, you know, remote education. Harvard is the kind of university that I would humbly suggest would never, ever have tried a 100% online education experiment. They just wouldn't have done it. The faculty is very proud of their accomplishments and think that their form of teaching is probably among the more effective. And so this forced experiment resulted in things like classes actually performing as well, if not better. I would argue that my class, which is a discussion-oriented class, had some real positive benefits and surprises in being taught remotely. You know, we were able to have discussion groups that were separate within the class, have segmentation of groups to be able to poll them differently, get honest assessments, etc. Now, of course, the surprise may be that the belief is you can't do that with physical lab-oriented classes. Well, I've had colleagues of mine that have actually prepared kits and sent them home, mailed them to students. And so you could do a physical experiment in front of a Zoom camera with your colleagues and peers all over. So I think there is a massive shift in higher education that is likely to happen. I think a large number of universities will probably fold. I think the residential education model may be shifting so that, you know, you will have students in person because there's some educational value for educational interaction outside of the classroom with peers. But there's a tailwind here that the cost of education is going to be tapped down. And one way to think about it is we're unbundling the social and residential experience from the educational experience. And, you know, residential liberal arts colleges will tell you those are intermingled and you can't separate them. But I think in some places you probably can. So I think that could actually help address the student loan problem. So that's a big change. The other thing I think, and we can get into this, this is separate and it's related to the COVID pandemic, but it's also a part of a much broader trend. I think we are going to see a massive regionalization then that accompanies a deglobalization, and that has huge implications for supply chains. And I think that has not been fully thought through. So those are some quick thoughts. Again, happy to go in whatever direction you think makes sense.
Well, let's go next to supply chains and what changes in the global economy in the broadest sense. Where are we going in terms of the way business changes and the way we do business changes as a result of this? And how do supply chains fit into that story?
Yeah. So the bottom line truth is there has been a massive increase in global economic uncertainty as perceived by corporate boardrooms of the multinational companies of the world. They've said, uh-oh, you know what? And by the way, this is a trend that was started well in advance of COVID-19 and will be accelerated because of COVID-19 and be accelerated because of other dynamics. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is we had this trade war start, really 16, 17 into 18, and that changed the dynamics of corporate boardrooms by saying, hey, you know what? This one part that was critical for my manufacturing used to cost $7, and now it's $48 because of tariffs and other things. That doesn't make me feel good. Now my profits are at risk. I'm not sure how this is going to work. Okay, we got to think about the supply chain shift so I don't have this geoeconomic pressure of a trade war that throws my profit projections and stability out the window. I got to change that. So supply chain started tiptoeing in a different direction. COVID-19 comes around, and because of the lockdowns, now companies are saying, wait, hold on a second. I think there was I think it was Fiat Chrysler had an issue in one of their plants in Europe that couldn't get a part that was essential for production out of China. And they said, wait, hold on. It's not even now about price. Now it's about security of supply, the availability of it. Wait, we got to really think about our supply chain shifting. Throw on top of that some geopolitics and the US-China trade war as being a lot more than a trade war. Think of it as a, you know, great power rivalry that comes with military escalation and all of the above. And now you start saying, you know what? Now there's a reason I just need to get my supply chains out of Asia because I'm a little bit worried. Maybe it's Chinese military modernization that leads to some effectively a threat to U.S. interests in Asia and my supply chains run there. Uh-oh, now I really need to move it back. add on top of that a couple of other dynamics. One is with technology. Because of automation and automated manufacturing, what we've seen is the labor component of manufactured goods has been plunging. And as it plunges, the labor arbitrage value of producing your goods in a country that has cheap labor has fallen. And so, you know, why should I bother putting my factory where there's lots of cheap people, cheap labor, if labor is not a big component of what I'm doing? So, you know, the labor arbitrage value disappeared. Throw on top of that the rising ESG concerns, and you remember and you think then that the longer the supply chain, the greater the carbon footprint. And so now there's an ESG pressure to make supply chains shorten. And lastly, you know, there used to be a tax arbitrage where I added the value would be taxed there. It turns out now with the US corporate tax rates a little more competitive on a global basis, the tax arbitrage value disappeared. And so things like freight actually become more important. And so what you find is that these supply chains are going to shorten. As they shorten, you're going to have manufacturing come closer to the end consumer. And when that happens, I think it creates a lot of pressure towards the emergence of two global ecosystems, a Chinese-led ecosystem and then a US or Western-led ecosystem. And that has massive implications for corporate boardrooms, as well as companies and countries all over the world. So yeah, I think that's sort of a real big picture answer to your question of how I see some of these pressures unfolding. And I think COVID-19 was an accelerant of some of these trends and made it a little more obvious that these other things mattered as well.
I want to come back to U.S.-China geopolitical relations because I think that's a very important topic. But first, just because you touched on it, I think there's a complacency in the United States. We have an attitude of, look, you know, we took China from being this rinky-dink third-world country to the second biggest economy in the world by outsourcing our manufacturing to them. We got them under our thumb. They need our money in order to grow their economy. They can't exist without us. Therefore, we can call all of the shots. I worry that that attitude of a lot of Americans embodies a lot of complacency, and that maybe there's a risk in coming years that China is working very intentionally to get to the point where they can say, you know what? We don't need you guys anymore. We've gotten to the point where we can both develop our own internal economy and sell our stuff to other people in the world. And we're ready to part ways, sort of the way the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union led to no trade between Eastern Bloc and Western Bloc countries. I think that we could be headed toward a China that doesn't want our business as opposed to one that is desperate for our business. And I'm convinced that's what they want. I just don't know how far away it is from being reality. Are we anywhere close to that? And is it realistic to think that's coming someday?
Oh, I think it is coming, Eric. I totally agree with your assessment. And I think the fact that I see a world emerging with two economic ecosystems, the trade between those ecosystems, I think is going to plunge. And that's exactly in line with your thesis and that you suggested. Now, how far along are we in that process? That's a tougher question to answer. And it's a tougher question to answer because of goods moving in intermediate steps, et cetera. So we don't really have, I think, a great understanding of China's ultimate dependency upon U.S. demand. There's still some dependency for sure. But the fact that the Chinese Communist Party took away their GDP projections this year, the fact that they've been emphasizing the Belt and Road to build future markets for their goods and services, and they're turning themselves west rather than east towards us, the fact that they're building out this Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and co-opting a whole bunch of countries that are not the U.S. indicates to me that that's absolutely part of their strategic game plan. And that's the progress that they've been making is in that direction. Add on top of that, Eric, that I think they had a credit-fueled investment bubble that burst. They overbuilt. But in the process of that overhang, some of us are missing the fact that under the surface of this investment-led slowdown and export-led slowdown is a consumer-led growth. Now, the COVID dynamics obviously disrupted that. but the Chinese economy was in fact transitioning towards more of a consumer-led society, in which case they needed exports less, they needed investment less, etc. So they were going in this direction, and I think you're very astute to suggest that that's their game plan.
Vikram, let's go ahead and get into U.S.-China geopolitical relations. Kind of feels to me like the calm before the storm, like maybe the attitude, at least in the beginning of the U.S. administration, was, okay, we got to have a talk with China, but let's get through this crisis first. And it seems like that's even changing to, now we're not going to wait till the crisis is over. We're going to mix it up with China right now. Where is this all headed? What do you think is coming next for U.S.-China relations? And particularly, you know, we negotiated this big trade deal. Is that all forgotten now, or are we going to abide by that? Or what do you think comes next?
Yeah, Eric, this is a gigantic question. I would argue this is probably the single most important issue facing the sort of global macroeconomic and geopolitical environment for the next, call it 10 years or so. This is a gigantic issue. And this is not just a trade war. This is not just a spat. This is great power rivalry. This is a trade war. This is a currency war. This is an economic war. This is a space race. This is an arms race. This is a geopolitical influence race. This is ultimately a competition of values. And that suggests to me that we are on the path towards, whether it's a cold or cool or warm war, however you want to define it, one hopes it stays peaceful, but it seems destined for issues and conflict in this rivalry. And again, one hopes it's not militarily or physical war, but that's a risk. So I would think a couple things are critical here. Number one, Hong Kong. Hong Kong situation is a tinderbox. And because of the fact that the government of China did agree to treat it differently and are now saying they won't treat it differently, I think that risks generating a geopolitical alliance led perhaps by the British to say, hold on a second, we had some deal here with Hong Kong and you're not upholding your end of it. And that could create pressure on China. Secondly, and a huge issue, I think, one that's being severely underestimated as a major issue by the world is Taiwan. I believe the Chinese are done with this idea of foreign influence on their soil. They view it as part of that century of humiliation, the fact that the foreigners carved us up, and Taiwan is this glaring sore thumb that's out there that they feel the need to address. How and when, I can't comment, but I do know they want to have Taiwan back in. And they're very upset about the fact that the U.S. sells military equipment to their wayward province. They're highly aware of the fact that the United States signed agreements that said there's one China based in Beijing, etc. So I think that's another flashpoint that could merge to be a potential problem. And then ultimately, there's this sort of war of values, globalization, good or bad. I remember in 2017 listening to Xi Jinping in Davos, and his talk was about globalization, free trade, and how the world can all prosper, and we're one big community, and we're going to move forward together. While the U.S. line at that point was, we're going to make America great and focus on ourselves first and protectionism, etc. So I think there are a whole bunch of different cross currents here, and that will be played out and affect almost everything. The big geopolitical implication, I think, of this rivalry, and it goes back to my comments earlier about the supply chain, is that countries around the world are going to have to choose. It's going to be very difficult to be a country and be, you know, effectively, quote unquote, friends, if you will, with both China and the U.S. And I think one country that's going to feel really torn is a country like Australia. You know, politically, definitely in the U.S. camp. Militarily, definitely in the U.S. camp. Economically, uh-oh, now we've got some tensions. The growth of China has supported the growth of Australia. And that creates some real internal tensions in a country like Australia. So I do think the pressures of the geopolitical rivalry are going to be felt far and wide across many different countries and across many different sectors, obviously, but definitely economically and politically.
Vikram, let's tie that perspective on foreign relations back into the economic situation and the risks that exist both to China's economy and to the U.S. economy. You know, something I never knew until this COVID-19 crisis is that the U.S. is completely dependent on China for prescription drugs. Almost all of the antibiotics are made either in China or they're made in India using raw materials sourced from China. So China has the ability to literally cut us off from prescription drugs, which if they were to do it in a sudden and, you know, using that as a military tool, if you would, they could literally cut off all of the aging and pharmaceutically dependent American population from the drugs they need to stay alive. And we don't have a backup plan, and we apparently never thought this through. What else is at risk, and what are the risks to China's economy as well if the U.S.-China relations go south, as you and I both seem to think they will?
Yeah, look, the pharmaceutical ingredients actually is yet another component of sort of the supply chain pressure, and you're 100% right to talk about it. I mean, some stats I remember, I recently gave a talk on this, but 95% of even non-prescription things like ibuprofen come from Chinese sources. 90% of vitamin C come from Chinese sources. And then I think it's like 91% of hydrocortisone, 70% of acetaminophen. And you're right, I think it's like 97% is the stat I remember of antibiotics come from Chinese sources. So yes, they have a major stranglehold on a key ingredient for which we are dependent upon them right now. I think that'll change over time, hopefully quicker to remove that vulnerability. But obviously another area and sector that people talk about are things like rare earth materials and rare earth metals. And these are needed for magnets, and they have some national security implications. They have some alternative energy implications, et cetera. And, that's a choke point right now in the world. Now, the benefit is rare earths are not actually that rare. They're actually spread all over the world. But they haven't been developed elsewhere. And so there's a couple of projects I'm aware of in North America that are working on trying to restore rare earth capacity here, given its strategic role in national security, as well as alternative energy, et cetera. And there's a lot of other sort of vulnerabilities, some with less significance. I mean, look, I think some large double digit percentage of footwear comes out of China. Okay, I'm pretty sure we can find other sources for footwear and we can sort of deal with that. But it's more the strategic ones that I worry about. The flip side is, I think the Chinese are actually dependent on finding sources of food and agricultural inputs. And the U.S. has historically supplied some of those. Obviously, Australia can supply some, and Brazil is another meaningful source. But it's a vulnerability that they think about, I think, a little bit. So I think those are some of the big sort of interrelated supply chain vulnerabilities that one should at least worry about and pay attention to. But your larger question about the economics, the sort of domestic economic situations, I think China has a lot of internal issues. Their economy has suffered tremendously because of the COVID crisis. They had a credit-fueled bubble, as I talked about earlier, that burst because they overbuilt. They're seeing an explosion in bad debt internal to their country, mainly because of that astronomical amount of debt that was issued to fund the build out, and then an economic slowdown. And that also is a toxic combination that could create unrest domestically. So I worry that the Chinese Communist Party might, quote unquote, wag the dog, for anyone that's seen that movie, but use some sort of distracting event outside the country to stir up nationalism and get people to be a little more oriented towards saying, hey, we're in this together. It was their fault. It was, you know, we need to suffer a little bit, but it's okay because we're on this long march towards greatness. And so I think there's some vulnerabilities domestically in China that are meaningful. And the thing I watch there is sort of bad debt levels. Now, obviously, the U.S. economy, I think, has a whole bunch of issues as well. You know, 70% dependent on the consumer, of which 70% are services. Some of those services, I don't think, are going to have the pent-up demand that people hope for, and talking about a V-shaped recovery. You know, Eric, if I go out to dinner with my family once a week, and my wife and I take our kids and we go to a nice restaurant, we sit down, we have a nice meal. Well, we've missed the last 10 of those or 15 of those, right? When are we going to feel comfortable going? I don't know, maybe it's another 5-10 weeks. When we do, are we going to really go out, you know, 25 times in the first month or two? No, that pent up demand doesn't exist. So in some of these services, you know, you have to see a headwind to the U.S. economy. And so consumer services being almost 50% of the economy, that's concerning. Throw on top of it bad debt, throw on top of it unemployment. And then a major issue, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is the faith in the US dollar, which I think at some point could result in a newfound vulnerability for the US economy. I mean, right now, as the global reserve currency, we're able to print. We're able to have a budget deficit that's, I can't even guesstimate where it's going to be, 20-something percent of GDP in the United States. I mean, as a student of emerging markets and as someone who's paid attention to financial booms and busts and bubbles bursting, when I hear of a budget deficit to GDP in double digits, I get concerned. When we're at 20-something percent, oh my God, I am really concerned. And the U.S. gets away with it because we have the global reserve currency. Now, if that were called into question, then I think we got much deeper issues at work that the U.S. economy will have to grapple with.
Let's talk then about what some of the things are that would bring that into question. Because as you say, you know, ever since 1944, the U.S. dollar has enjoyed this role of being the world's global reserve currency. One of the things I question is whether we need to have just one specific, you know, in the old days, you had to choose one so that people didn't have to hold lots of different currencies. In an environment where you can just do a Forex transaction at the click of a mouse, you don't need to have a single currency for global trade the way you used to. But you still have the question of the network effect of central bank reserve assets. So what are the factors? Obviously, there's a lot of frustration around the world. Russia and China have been very outspoken in saying they don't like the fact that the U.S. dollar is the global reserve currency, but there doesn't seem to be a viable alternative either. So what would happen or what could happen to create that viable alternative that would cause the dollar to lose its hegemony over the global economy?
Sure. I think you're hitting the nail on the head here, Eric, by saying that it's really the lack of an alternative, that it's sort of the Tina logic, if you will, right? There's no alternative to the dollar, so therefore the dollar will reign supreme. So I think there's a couple of different options that could emerge. Number one, I do think, as you've highlighted, the Chinese and Russians are very upset about this U.S. dollar reserve status and would love to change it. Now, could you imagine a world where over time certain commodities are priced not in dollar terms? Perhaps the reference price for oils moves to being in yuan, or the reference price for gold or for other commodities moves to being in another currency. So that might be a start, and then you might see some dynamics around that. But ultimately, I don't think the global community of users of currency, meaning large corporations, individuals, et cetera, will have the faith in a Chinese currency unless it were gold or precious metals backed in some capacity. And they may do some percentage backing or what have you. But I think that's one possibility. And I think that's a 15, 20-year type plan. I think the Belt and Road Initiative was actually part of that strategy, right? I mean, the U.S. Marshall Plan that took place here post-World War was to effectively rebuild Europe using our extra capacity, build it, create markets for our goods and services, and ensure trade took place in U.S. dollar terms. If we drew the analogy to the Belt and Road, well, the Belt and Road is using extra capacity within China to build future markets for goods and services in Central Asia into Africa up to Europe. And hopefully, or I mean, I think in the Chinese eyes, hopefully have that trade take place in Chinese yuan or renminbi terms. So I think this is a sort of grander, longer term plan. And, you know, they may chip away at the dollar hegemony in the short run, but I don't think there's any meaningful risk to dollar hegemony anytime soon. Now, with that said, there's some sort of non-currency currencies that I sort of refer to them as, which is, you know, you can think of gold as a non-currency currency, but, you know, trade is not taking place in gold. But from an investment perspective, that's one way to sort of protect yourself. And then, of course, there are some of these digital and cryptocurrencies. I'm by no means an expert on them, but, you know, the idea of something that cannot be politically manipulated or printed gives me great comfort in today's environment.
Well, don't put it past them to come up with digital currencies that can be politically manipulated and printed.
Sure, sure.
There's lots of possibility on the horizon, needless to say. Let's move on now to another topic that we've been covering quite a bit here on Macro Voices, which is for more than a quarter of a century now, the economic backdrop has been either disinflation or outright deflation. A lot of people are starting to anticipate that maybe we're close to a shift, a secular shift, to inflation or stagflation. Number one, do you agree with that prognosis? And much more importantly, number two, if so, what does it look like? How would that transition occur? How long would it take? What would the implications be?
Yeah, look, it's a fabulous question, Eric, because it transitions nicely from our prior discussion here of reserve currency status. So in the long run, I do think if the US dollar is at risk, we would see a massive devaluation of dollars, and that would result in a massive importing of inflation, right? So we would see, if the dollar depreciated dramatically, that the cost of imports would rise, goods pricing would rise, et cetera. I mean, I don't want to be alarmist, but if we were to go back and study history to see how did Venezuela get hyperinflation? How did Zimbabwe get hyperinflation? How did Weimar Germany get hyperinflation? There's a couple of ingredients that tend to recur. One of them for sure is printing money, right? So, all right, we'll check that box here in the United States. Another one is deficit spending of large amounts. Okay, well, I guess, you know, with a 20% of budget deficit or plus even higher than that, you can probably check that box. And then massive devaluation occurs that results in the inflation getting out of control. We haven't had that here in America. In fact, we've had the opposite, right? Strong dollar in this world. And so, you know, that would be something to watch. If you were watching for hyperinflation, I would watch the dollar. That could create the hyperinflationary dynamic. On the flip side, the sort of shorter term, let's call it a 3 to 5 year view, if not even shorter than that, the pressures I think still show that technology, so let's talk about the pressures. One is for sure technology, massive deflationary force on the world, on the economy, on goods and services, et cetera. And for better or worse, technology seems destined to continue providing that deflationary pressure. On the flip side, I think we're starting to see more friction in the system, right? The build out of a totally new economic, separate economic system, going from one globalized system to two globalized ecosystems, that's friction. And friction sort of adds or subtracts supply, if you will. And so maybe that's actually a little bit of inflationary pressure by having that frictional sort of introduction in that mix. But then you have a reduction in demand because of demographics. So when you look through demographics, you see the aging of the world's largest populations. That's probably a reduction in demand. And so when I look and put all these in the mix together, what I see is, you know, mild inflationary pressure building, sort of, if you will, here in the United States. But the things to watch that I'm paying attention to is, number one, friction in the sort of build out of these supply chains. The higher the cost, the slower the time, the flow through cost impact, that would change my view to say more inflation sooner. Secondly, I'm watching technology. If we in fact choose to regulate it, tax the robots, in fact, break up big tech, you know, put sand effectively into the gears of productivity that technology's provided, well, that would be inflationary. And I would be concerned and watch that. And then, you know, obviously the traditional metrics to watch are wages rising. And if we've got this dynamic where wages rise and prices rise, well, that, of course, that wage price spiral is something to always watch for. And I think the central bankers are good to watch for that. But, you know, for better or worse, I think right now, barring meaningful pressures in those ways that I just highlighted, we're sort of, you know, deflationary into slightly inflationary, but nothing alarming anytime soon that I see. Now, I'm watching very cautiously and very alert. I mean, my ears are perked up, my eyes are wide open, and I'm paying attention because it does feel like there's a imminent change in this deflation to inflationary thinking process in the data. It hasn't yet come through. And so I'm watching it. But I'm sort of nervously watching, but I don't have strong convictions yet.
Vikram, I want to go back to 2011 when you wrote a book called Boombustology, which was quite popular. For our listeners who may not be familiar with it, please give us the rundown on that book before we move on to your recent book.
Sure. Well, thanks for asking, Eric. So that book was really a framework for thinking about financial bubbles before they burst. And so it was actually a fairly straightforward framework, which is using five different lenses to gauge whether you're in a bubble and the relative maturity of that bubble. Obviously, it's impossible to precisely time things like a bubble bursting, but you can get yourselves in the right neighborhood. And so what were those five lenses? The first lens was microeconomics, looking at prices and demand. So historical economic analysis would have you lead to the conclusion that higher prices equal less demand or lower prices equal more demand. But what happens when you get higher prices resulting in more demand? I would argue to you, you've got a bubbly dynamic underway. And by the way, you can see this. I mean, this is the FOMO trade, right? Higher prices, oh my God, I'm afraid. I'm going to miss out. Let me get in. And so higher prices resulting in more demand is a bubbly dynamic. Doesn't mean you're in a bubble. Just check one out of five. The second one is, let's go to the macroeconomic lens first, which is mispriced money. So mispriced money is misused money. So when money is allocated in ways that might not make sense if it were priced more normally, then you'd be concerned. So one way to see a difference in sort of the appropriate pricing of money is to look at the delta between real economies, sort of economic activity, and financial market activity. And when you see big divergences there, that may be that money is being channeled towards more speculation rather than investment. And so that's a concern, mispriced money, misused money. So investment in the face of overcapacity is a telltale sign. And so, you know, when I looked at Las Vegas in 2007 and 8, there was plenty of overcapacity and people were investing a lot in the gaming sector to build out more casino capacity, et cetera, using borrowed money. That's sort of a classic example. Lens three is overconfidence. The fact that it's quote unquote different this time. There's a new technology. It's the new thing. And there's lots of ways to see this, but you can watch, honestly, popular sentiment where, you know, magazine covers talk about it's different this time. How, you know, insert the technology. Back in the 1920s, it was the car, radio. Back in, you know, 99, 2000, it was the internet. You know, every time there's something that says it's different, usually. And then the fourth lens is political manipulation and moral hazard. And so when investors believe that there's a heads I win, tails you lose trade, or you might think of, hey, I have an embedded put for whatever reason, central bank oriented or otherwise, that I'm more willing to take risk. And so I don't worry about losses. And when you have that biased risk reward trade-off, you see bubbly activity. And then finally, I look through a lens of sort of epidemiology to look at thinking about a bubble as a fever running through a population. And, you know, if you draw that analogy, what you start looking to is how many people are still left to infect. And there, when you have dinner party conversations talking about a particular asset class, or your taxi cab driver's giving you a stock tip, or the bellman at a hotel you visit says, hey, I just bought and flipped this condo or did that, then you know it's too late. That's a late inning phenomenon, if we stuck with the baseball analogy. And so anyway, the boombustology was that framework described, used through historical cases. And again, in 2011, I then applied it to the case of China and suggested that China was in the midst of a credit-fueled investment bubble that was going to slow down, burst, and the result would be a sort of headwind against Chinese economic growth and implications for commodities, emerging markets, et cetera. So yeah, that was boombustology. Thanks for asking.
And you've written a new book called Think for Yourself, which will be released on June 16th, but is available right now for pre-order on Amazon. What's that one about?
Yeah, so this is my attempt to take, Eric, that same multi-lens logic and apply it to navigating all forms of uncertainty. And one of the biggest challenges I think many of us face today is how we interact with experts and the inputs we get into our decision-making processes. And so what I'm suggesting in this book is we all need to take ownership of our decision-making. We have to stop outsourcing our thinking to experts, and we need to reclaim control. The phrases I use to talk about that are things like, we have to keep experts on tap, not on top. that we need to triangulate through multiple expert opinions, not just one, because every lens is biased and incomplete. So let's use multiple lenses, and that means tapping into multiple experts. And ultimately, it's about trying to think for yourself by imagining the opposite of expert advice, imagining alternative futures, and then owning your own decision by thinking about the big picture. So realizing, for instance, that experts all live in silos and are structurally unable to see the big picture. And when they're unable to see the big picture, they therefore can't take over your decision making. Now, you shouldn't let them. So, you know, there's other messages in the book, the fact that breadth is undervalued relative to depth, and that we should maybe have a more healthier balance when thinking about broad versus narrow and deep, and dynamics like that. But the book is really about navigating uncertainty and a framework for doing so in all walks of life: medical decision making, financial decision making, education decision making, etc.
Well, Vikram, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was a great interview with Vikram, and even during the interview, you guys touched on the riots and everything that's going on. So in this post game, let's touch on the civil unrest in the United States over the last week. Listeners, I've prepared a chart deck showing market reactions to prior civil unrest events. You'll find that link in the chart book in your Research Roundup email. And if you don't have the Research Roundup email, you can just go to the homepage of macrovoices.com and click the red button that says looking for the download. Now, Eric, you've been predicting an increase in civil unrest in the United States for years now. Is what we're seeing this in the past week what you were predicting? And what caused you to make those predictions to start with?
Well, Patrick, for the record, when I moved out of the United States and moved to Hong Kong in 2009, one of the reasons is that I predicted riots in the streets by 2012, approximately the same thing that we're seeing this week I thought was going to happen 8 or 9 years ago. So I was either dead wrong or almost a full decade early, whichever way you want to spin that. And there have been several false starts where I thought what I had predicted was starting with Occupy Wall Street, which ended up kind of fizzling out. Then in 2014, there was the Ferguson, Missouri riots. And then the next thing was probably around 2016, the four Dallas police officers who were killed. Then in 2017, we had the Charlottesville car attack. In each of those cases, I was thinking, okay, maybe we've just hit the self-sustaining chain reaction tipping point, which is going to cause this violence and unrest to escalate rather than de-escalate. In each one of those cases, I couldn't be happier, Patrick, about admitting that I got those calls wrong or early or something, because in each of those cases, there was several weeks of unrest, but it did eventually de-escalate, thankfully. Now, as far as what's going on this week, certainly the killing of George Floyd by a police officer was the catalyst. It was the spark that got this going, the straw that broke the camel's back, if you will. But I don't think that George Floyd really has anything to do with the true cause of this. The reason we're seeing all of this unrest around the country is because of what Chris Martinson has described as wealth inequality for a decade now. What we have is a situation ever since the great financial crisis where the government is bailing out financial markets, frankly, at the expense of hardworking people. And those hardworking people are, in many cases, don't fully understand what's happening to them, but they do understand that there's inequity there. And I think that's what's been driving this. George Floyd was just the proximal catalyst that got this particular round going.
A minute ago, you were saying something about a tipping point where escalation of civil unrest becomes a self-sustaining chain reaction. Can you explain and elaborate on what you mean by that chain reaction?
Sure, and this is based just on my own theory and my own interpretation of history and past events. There's a two-part tipping point system, which I feel is essential to understand. And think kind of like a nuclear fission chain reaction, where there has to be certain elements in place in order to sustain the chain reaction. And if those elements are in place, it just keeps escalating and getting bigger from there. So the first side of this is what I call the public perception tipping point. In normal times, Patrick, clashing with the police is something that only criminals do. So good, law-abiding citizens don't do it. They don't get involved in clashing with police. And if there's a peaceful protest that starts to escalate into something violent, all of those good, law-abiding citizens just turn around and walk away and don't want to have anything to do with that violent escalation. What happens is those people never make a decision, hey, I'm going to become a criminal and start clashing with police. Rather, they experience a perception that the situation has changed to where it's no longer that the criminals are clashing with police. Rather, they perceive it as people are fighting back against tyranny. They're being oppressed, and good law-abiding citizens ought to fight back and resist that tyranny. So it's a perception by the public that suddenly the police are the ones that are breaking the law and that they're not doing something wrong. They're not being criminal to resist it violently. What that leads to is the second side of this, which is the law enforcement tipping point. Now, as much as a lot of people will criticize police and say they're all corrupt and so forth, the reality of the situation is you've got some really bad apples in the police department, unfortunately, but the majority of police officers are doing their job and doing a good job of respecting the rights of citizens and so forth. What happens is, as those guys see their fellow officers literally being run down in the streets, as has happened this week, run over by cars, police officers being shot and killed, just being attacked for no reason other than being police officers, then law enforcement goes through their own perceptual tipping point where they perceive suddenly, okay, this has turned into all-out war. It's us against them. We got to shoot before we get shot. And all of a sudden, there's a major escalation of force by law enforcement because they're going through their own tipping point. That escalation of force leads to a larger percentage of the public having its perception tipping point triggered, where they perceive this is no longer something about the criminals and the police. This is the police attacking law-abiding citizens, and now we're at war with one another. That's the way that the chain reaction works, is you have those two tipping points where each time one gets triggered, it feeds into and allows the other one to get triggered to its next level of escalation. If that process continues and they continue to escalate back and forth, eventually it goes completely crazy and you get to, you know, outright revolution and civil war and that kind of thing. Thankfully, every time these things have gotten started, whether it was Ferguson or Charlottesville or the Dallas police killings or what have you, there was a few weeks of unrest, and it all settled back down again.
Okay, but to your own admission, you first predicted this tipping point of self-sustaining chain reaction escalating a full decade ago, and despite a few false starts like Ferguson, Missouri, Charlottesville, and Dallas police murders, in each of those cases, there was a brief period of escalation, a violent protest, but in each of those cases, it settled down and de-escalated after a few weeks. Like, do you see anything different about this current outbreak that makes you think that it's different this time?
Well, Patrick, let's hope not. I certainly hope that things de-escalate. But what could be different this time, what feels like it's different this time, is in the past, we've had an event happen in one place. A guy got killed in Ferguson, Missouri. There were riots in Ferguson, Missouri. There were some bad actors who traveled to Ferguson, Missouri, just so they could be part of the protests and so forth there. But it kind of stayed localized. There were some sympathy protests around the country, but they never got to be as big as the protest that was going on in Ferguson. What you see this time is all of a sudden, all across the country, all at once, there are massive protests. In some cases, the protests elsewhere are bigger and more violent than the ones that are going on in Minneapolis. Now, if all of those things were happening spontaneously and organically, suggesting that everybody across the country is just so fed up and so pissed off that they're resorting to violence. Then I would say, hey, that's a really big sign that it's different this time. And the first half, the public perception tipping point, is getting triggered in a much bigger way than the previous events. And that could lead to a really, really negative outcome. The thing is, I'm not at all persuaded that this is happening organically. Now, at first, when people on Twitter and around the internet were pointing out the mysterious appearance of pallets of bricks in these cities where protests were occurring, they were instantly labeled as conspiracy theorists and nutcases and alarmists who were circulating propaganda that was nonsense and so forth. Well, just today, the Department of Justice announced a formal investigation because police departments around the country are reporting that they are encountering what feels to them like signs of coordinated command and control, that these protests are being orchestrated by some kind of centrally planned entity. So how you interpret that is really a big question mark. Does that mean that we've reached the perceptual tipping point of the public where things have gotten so bad that a whole bunch of people have gone out and gotten organized, which would be a very bearish case, if you will, in terms of where it could be headed? Or is it just that a very small number of particularly bad actors are trying to influence the system and make it worse than it really is by organizing these events to occur in a way which creates a perception of a much more upset public than actually exists? I'm not sure which is going on here, but I do think that we have a potential perfect storm setting up in terms of what is on the calendar in coming months, because a second wave of the COVID-19 crisis was very likely, from all the reading that I've done, completely independent of this unrest and so forth. Even if there had been no civil unrest, it was still very likely, probably right around election time, around, you know, as the weather starts to get colder in the Northern Hemisphere, that you would have a second wave of the COVID-19 crisis. Well, what we've got a setup for is current events, the current uprising, is almost certainly going to be blamed by the other side, if you will, as the primary cause of the second wave. We were out of the COVID-19 crisis. We had passed the peak. Everything was better. We were on our way back to prosperity. And then those stinking protesters went, and because of their riots in the streets, that's what caused the second wave. So you'll get one large group of people who believes that story with incredible passion, because in many cases, they'll have loved ones who were killed by the pandemic, who died from COVID-19, and they feel that it's the protesters that caused the second wave that led to the death of their loved ones. Meanwhile, you've got already a rapidly growing group of people who think that this entire lockdown thing was a contrived act of tyranny, that it was never necessary, that it was invented by government, that it never should have happened, and that it was an egregious affront to the civil liberties of the American people. Those people are going to feel, you know, it just creates this big us versus them blame game of who was responsible for the second wave, and was it caused by the riots, or did the riots have nothing to do with it? It doesn't matter who's right in this story. You know, I think to the analogy of a religious war, where the problem you have is everybody thinks God is on their side. You have a situation where people have such strongly held views about whether or not the pandemic itself is real and whether the lockdowns are a good idea, that they're going to be blaming the other side for not respecting their interpretation of the facts. Doesn't even matter what the actual facts are. The point is, it's a setup for further divisiveness, for further tension, and for a further escalation of unrest and social tension across the country. When might that lead to some kind of crescendo or breaking tipping point? Well, the U.S. election in November is the obvious make or break event. So I think that, you know, hopefully what we'll see is a de-escalation from here. Everything will get better. And hopefully the officer who appears to have murdered George Floyd will be held accountable for his crime, and there will be justice served, and everybody will calm down, and the violence will go away. Unfortunately, the risk is that it doesn't go that way, that we keep seeing an escalation of social division and of violence leading up to a crescendo with the U.S. election. And at that point, you've got a setup where half the country is going to feel like a horrific injustice has just occurred. The anti-Trump crowd is going to feel, if the president is reelected, as though that was a horrific miscarriage of justice. The Trump supporters, if he's not reelected, are going to feel like he was taken out unjustly by the deep state and it was all unwarranted. Again, it doesn't matter who's right or wrong. The point is, it's a setup for a lot of really strong social division across the country. Now, this whole thing has the potential to take on international proportions because the narrative that says the COVID-19 virus, SARS-CoV-2, was made in a laboratory and leaked out of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, that narrative is gaining more and more traction. And again, it doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong. The point is, some people are going to think it's right and some people are going to think it's wrong. And that could lead us to the point where there's a major outlash of anger around the world against China. China, of course, will feel like they are being unfairly targeted. They'll respond with economic sanctions and so forth. And it just leads to more and more potential tension and growth of geopolitical tension around the world. So needless to say, we live in interesting times. And I think now through the November elections is going to be a big tell. Is everything going to de-escalate or is it going to get worse from here? I have no idea, but this is a time to pay close attention.
All right. Well, let's talk about what this means for the stock market. You know, obviously, stocks are up during this week of the violence, and I put up some charts to talk about it. But let's start with what is your take on all of this?
Well, as I said in the market wrap, my sense is markets are anticipating massive government stimulus, primarily accommodative Fed policy, to a lesser extent fiscal stimulus. It looks like another $1 trillion round of fiscal stimulus is about to come out of Congress. I think that's what's driving markets. But it's important too, Patrick, to remember, you know, it's tempting to think, oh, well, clearly in a normal circumstance, the kind of unrest that we're seeing would normally imply a crashing stock market. That's not really true. I want to thank you, Patrick, for putting together a terrific chart deck. Again, listeners, you'll find the download link to the chart deck in your Research Roundup email. Patrick, let's go ahead and dive into the chart deck, starting on page 2. You're showing here the Martin Luther King assassination. You know, that didn't cause a crash in the stock market. On page 3, you're showing the Rodney King riots didn't cause a crash in the stock market. So what does history teach us about what we should be expecting during times like these?
Well, I think the single thing to take away is that there isn't a lot of precedent that the stock market is responsive to the social unrest and civil unrest that has happened in the past. And at least there's no precedent for it. And it doesn't mean that inevitably can't. I mean, I think of what was happening with the yellow jackets in France, and the CAC appears to have been dropping during that time. But that was during that really big market, global market drop. And so I don't think you want to even associate it with that. The point is that these things are very emotional and they're scary, but the stock markets don't seem to take it as a react. They don't react anyway to it, at least in the past. So what I wanted to touch on, though, Eric, moving on, is I wanted to just touch on this move in yields. And to me, it is certainly very interesting that we had this pop in yields up to 80 basis points on the 10-year treasury yield. But really, with the Fed intervention and the Fed funds rate being basically pinned to the lower bound, this is entirely a bear steepener that is kicking in. And really, to my mind, there are two drivers. I don't have a chart of the dollar here, but clearly the dollar breakdown, as the dollar weakness tends to be one one of the core drivers behind inflationary impulses, as it usually drives commodity rallies and other things that cause inflation expectations to rise. And so the big question that we want to continuously ask here, is this really it? Is this the turn point that is going to drive yields higher, create the steepener because the front end of the curve is pinned, drive a substantial rise in steepening and inflation expectations? And I'd love to get your take on it. Like, because this, to me, this is really about, is this dollar move just noise, just one of its normal temporary moves? Or is this a major shift in the dollar? Because I think that would be a massive contributor to a rise in inflation expectations and subsequently drive these steepening trades to really start to gain some momentum here. What's your take on that?
Well, Patrick, the best that I can do is to answer your question with more questions. I think the important questions that we have to ask to eventually get to the real bottom line is, number one, is the zero bound a meaningful number? Is it, you know, the reason that we're kind of bottoming out here because we got to almost zero? Or is zero just a step along the way to the possibility of deeply negative yields on the U.S. 10-year? I don't know the answer as to whether or not there's a meaningful boundary there. That's the reason I've been asking a lot of our expert guests that question. The other, I think, probably more important question is, I'm pretty much convinced that we are nearing a transition phase where we move from secular deflation or disinflation toward inflation or stagflation. Well, is that really starting now? If so, that would explain this reversal, and it would suggest that we're about to move to much higher bond yields. Or is it more likely the case that it's going to take 3 to 5 years for that transition to play out, and maybe there's still more deflation to be felt before we get into that transition, in which case that's a different story. So I think those are the two important questions that you have to ask. What the answers are to those, it's beyond my pay grade. I don't know. That's the reason I try to ask all of our feature interview guests those questions wherever I can.
Well, you know, I really do believe that the thing to watch is the dollar, right? I mean, there's no doubt that we just saw the break, but is this a sustained trend? Because when currencies start trending, they don't trend for 1 month or a couple of weeks. They trend for a half a year or even multiple years. And I still don't believe that this is the beginning of a major dollar breakdown, though over a long enough time horizon, we will eventually be due for one. And so it's solving that puzzle is going to be, I think, one of the key pieces to determining whether or not inflation is starting up sooner than not.
Well, you know, another way to put that, Patrick, something I've said for years is there's no doubt in my mind that our friend Luke Groman will be proven right in the end. The thing is, I thought he was early when he started talking about the dollar really entering a secular decline phase several years ago. I'd say that I've been proven out as being correct that Luke was early in his view. I don't think he was wrong. So is it time already for Luke to be proven right that the dollar is going to make a final reversal to the downside and kind of lose a lot of value as the U.S. dollar stops being the de facto global reserve currency and a lot of things change in the system? Or are we not quite far enough into this story for Luke to start being proven right? I still don't know, but I'm convinced in the end, Luke's view will prevail.
All right, Eric, let's return now back to the bigger picture in terms of the civil unrest. What's your take on the range of possibilities and where we could be headed here?
Well, it's a massively wide range of possibility. Crowd psychology is famously difficult to predict. A distinct possibility is that the current unrest dissipates after a few weeks, just like Ferguson, Missouri dissipated. That was a situation that was brought about by a remarkably similar catalyst, a person of color being killed by a police officer. It seemed like the situation was just crazy and going out of control. A few weeks later, things started to settle down. So there's the potential that this settles down as well. The potential accelerants, the catalysts that could make things much worse, number one, the COVID-19 blame game. If we get into a situation, I'm noticing this already, whether you wear a mask out in public is taking on this social meaning. It's almost like wearing a red Make America Great Again baseball cap. It's as if you're associating yourself or taking sides in a very strongly divided political divide just by the act of wearing a mask, because people on one side have one strong view about how all responsible citizens have to wear masks in public. Other people feel like wearing a mask is a sign of not believing in freedom and liberty and so forth. Again, it doesn't matter who's right or wrong. The point is the people on both sides have very strong convictions in their views. It's a setup for more social division and potentially a further escalation of civil unrest. Next thing, number two, presidential election. Either outcome is going to leave half of the country feeling like a horrific injustice has just occurred. Doesn't matter who's right or who's wrong. The point is half the country is going to be pissed off no matter what. So at the time of the election, when the announcement of the result occurs, that's potentially a trigger point for more unrest. Number three, if the lab-made narrative about the SARS-CoV-2 virus gains further traction, if more people believe that it was a result of a leak from the Wuhan Institute of Virology that led to this entire pandemic, that potentially, and again, it doesn't matter whether that's right or wrong, whether it really happened or not. The point is, if people perceive that to be the case, it leads to anger against China. That leads to China reacting defensively. It leads to compromised trade and geopolitical tension between nations, potentially even leads to military escalation. A lot of things that could go wrong there. The real big if here is if we get to the point where that two-part chain reaction, where first you have the public changing their view to where people who never would have clashed with the police start to think it's not a criminal thing anymore because the circumstances have changed. That leads to more violence against police. The violence against police leads the police to get even tougher in their tactics because they're watching their fellow officers get killed in the line of duty. And all of a sudden, you've got a massive escalation. Now, look, those are the kind of things, you know, that if you want to know what the beginning of a civil war looks like, those are the kind of events that precipitate it. Now, before everybody freaks out on me, I did not just predict a civil war. I said that's the way it starts. Most of the time when you have the circumstances, which are the way civil wars start, they don't start civil wars. Things de-escalate, people calm down, and those moments in history are forgotten. Hopefully this moment in history will be forgotten too. The point is, though, that you know there's really no limit to where this goes. It's a question of how much that tipping point of tension between the government and the people escalates. And unfortunately, when you have catalysts like a global pandemic, even though that's not really the core issue, it really just adds fuel to the fire because people are blaming one another for who caused the pandemic, who caused this second wave to occur. Was it because of the riots that are going on right now that that's what caused the second wave? It's going to lead to a lot of social division. So it's all a really big boiling point. And again, I don't think any of this is about George Floyd. The real underlying issue is wealth inequality. Chris Martinson has a chart showing that the top 0.1% is almost at the point now of owning more wealth than the entire bottom 90% of society. That's got to piss a lot of people off. And I think that that trend, which has really been going on since about 1980, of financialization of the economy, supporting Wall Street, it's not the kind of capitalism that I believe in. Unfortunately, I think capitalism is being blamed as the problem. It would be a return of capitalism that I think would be the solution to our current problems. A lot of people don't see it that way. So there's really no limit to the range of possibility here. Let's all hope that things de-escalate and we learn to get along with one another. And on that note, Patrick, we're going to call it a show for this week. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplug.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to pre-order Vikram's Think for Yourself new book. You'll also find a link to Variant Perception article about the pandemic as a potential trigger for QE in emerging markets, and an oilprice.com article about what's holding natural gas prices back. And so you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, and myself, @PatrickSeresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email, containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Seresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.